Good evening, a very warm welcome to the LSE. I'm David Walter, I'm president of the Media Society. We like to think of ourselves as the leading forum for debate about the future of journalism, and there's never been a week when that debate has been more pressing and interesting and urgent. I do urge any of you who aren't members of the Media Society to join us. You can see our website on the banner there. And my very, very warm congratulations to Charlie Beckett of Polis, who has pulled this together at very short notice. He has assembled a sparkling panel for you, which he will now introduce. Charlie.
Thanks very, very much, David. As he says, my name is Charlie Beckett. I'm director of Polis, which is the media and journalism think tank here at the London School of Economics. I confess I was or am a journalist as well, and I've got a fantastic panel today to discuss obviously what is an extraordinary story, an extraordinary set of issues, and because it's been happening so extraordinarily rapidly, we've got panellists who have piled out of Number 10 and out of newsrooms and so on, and so inevitably it's going to be something of a feast of different parts. But we're very, very keen, obviously, to try and get you engaged as quickly as possible and to get as many voices from the floor as well. So in advance, I beg people to be quite brief. I have, in no particular order, on my far right, David Aranovich, who I'm sure you're familiar with, columnist with The Times. To my right is Paul Staines, blogger Guido Fawkes. To my left, Charlotte Harris from Mishcon. And to my far left, Martin Moore, who's going to kick us off. Martin is the director of the Media Standards Trust. So they're just going to take 5 minutes each to answer what is a rather crude question, but I think it's one that's on a lot of people's lips, which is it time, in the wake of the hacking scandal, to get tough on the press? Martin.
Yeah.
Sorry.
Can I grab the water?
Sorry.
Please excuse me. I have a bad throat, so I shall do my best to be heard. I'll also try and collect my thoughts, because as Charlie says, it's been quite a ride over the last week or so. We spent a little while, and I run the Media Standards Trust, it's a charity. We do some research and development, some of you might be familiar with us, but for a few years now we've been concerned about, particularly about the whole issue of accountability and transparency in the press, and we've written some reports about the Press Complaints Commission and its insufficiencies. And about 2 years ago, actually it was just after Nick Davis did some of his first revelations. So it was July 2009 when he broke the story about Gordon Taylor. And we were pretty astonished by the story. No one else really picked it up. The Guardian did its best to try and make clear that this was significant. It tried to do its best to make clear that this was evidence that things went beyond the one rogue reporter argument that the News of the World had been making. And it didn't get picked up. We did our best as well to say this is an important moment. It's an important moment to for the press to look at itself and say, let's do an inquiry, let's sort ourselves out, let's think about what's gone wrong, and air our dirty laundry. Now, I know that's not comfortable for anyone to do, but the press certainly wasn't in the mood to do it then. It wasn't in the mood to do it when The Guardian broke further allegations about how widespread this went. It wasn't ready to do it when the New York Times did its investigation last September. And then finally last Monday, the dam broke. The dam broke with the Million Dollar Story again, Nick Davis. And I think it's important to say all this, and I'm sure other people will say as well, that this would not have come out were it not for good journalism, for dogged journalism, and for digging and digging and digging. Because certainly, the politicians were not keen to dig around and pull us out, and certainly the police were not keen to dig around and pull us out, and none of the other members of the press. So I'll fast forward, Charlie, but I mean, to the question, specific question at hand, I think one thing I would like to do and like us to do on the panel is to try and actually just take a breath, because we are still in quite a frenzied environment, it seems to me. I think probably understandably, given what we learned last week, but I think everyone needs to take a breath and say, okay, what exactly does this mean for the future of press? We've always been very, very clear that self-regulation is infinitely preferable from the government intervention in the press, but clearly self-regulation didn't work. We have to rethink the whole environment, and we have to rethink the environment in the context of not just what's happened or what is alleged to have happened at News of the World and elsewhere, but also in the context of, I mean, I don't know how brief people's memories are, but it was only, was it last month, that we were just endlessly discussing privacy injunctions.
Super injunctions, yeah.
Yeah, so it has to be seen in the context of the privacy debate, it has to be seen in the context of technology, and the technological debate, and the degree to which one ever wants to have, or is even practical to have, some sort of regulation in the environment we live now. I'll stop talking there, but I think, as I say, it's time to take a breath. We have, I think, a remarkable opportunity now, in a way, to rethink things, that clearly didn't work, but it will be a short space, so I think we need to rethink them reasonably quickly, and people need to get stuck in, and particularly journalists need to get stuck in, and to be frank and honest about what went wrong, and think about the best way to put it right, and to prevent any sort of state intervention which could absolutely restrict free press and free speech.
Great, thank you very, very much, Martin. Paul.
I'm well known as a blogger, but I also have had some 20 years of selling stories to the newspapers. My first front page was when I just got kicked out of university and was front page in The Observer, so I've had a lot of experience of being at the sharp end of dealing with papers, and I thought I would mention some stories and some case studies of my experiences. First of all, I think I'd like to set the meta context or the background to the whole situation. I don't know if people remember, and I'm not sure how well informed you are about these things, but the Information Commissioner in 2006 had a report out where they had charted who had done the most blagging. That's not quite hacking, but that's having a contact in the DVLA, the police, or the land registry, who gives you information that you shouldn't really be able to get hold of. And it wasn't News International that came top, it was the Mirror Group, including the People, followed by Associated Press, the Mail, then News International, and then the Telegraph. So when you realise what's been going on at News International, think what's been going on at the other papers, because they were no more moral or less inhibited about chasing after stories. Something that struck me as interesting, I didn't realise that Charlotte was Ulrika's lawyer. And there's something I wanted to point out to you from Piers Morgan's diaries, the insider, the private diaries of a scandalous decade. So forgive me for quoting. Friday the 26th of January. Apparently, if you don't change the standard security code that every phone comes with, then anyone can call your number. And if you don't answer, tap in the standard four-digit code to hear all your messages. I'll change mine just in case. But it makes me wonder, how many public figures and celebrities are aware of this little trick? Now that was 2001. 2002, The Mirror, edited by Piers Morgan, has this fascinating story about Ulrika and Sven Goran Eriksson and their affair. Now, it's quite a legend, this story, and people have been dining out on it for a long time. So I'll be explicit about what happened. Jamie Scott, who was the showbiz reporter, was listening to voicemails, and they were Eureka's voicemails, and they were in Swedish, and he didn't understand them, but they did have a half Swedish secretary. So they got her to listen into the voice. They all sound like Sven Goran Eriksson, don't they? So you know how it goes. And it turns out it is Sven Goran Eriksson, and he, from the conversation they're having, is quite intimate with Eureka. So they front them, they cough the story, They run the story. You know, Swedish shaggers, blah, blah, blah. But Piers Morgan is getting a lot of flack at the time because he set up 3AM Girls, which is their showbiz and gossip column, and it's not doing very well. So he says to Jamie Scott, look, we give it to 3AM Girls, we'll probably win an award for it. And I'll make it up to you. Jamie Scott, who got the story, gets promoted over to the Sunday People. And sure enough, at the British Press Awards the following year, the 3AM Girls win the Scoop of the Year based on hacking of phones. The showbiz editor at the time, who would have obviously known, given it was a reporter who got the story, was one Richard Wallace. He's now the editor of the Daily Mirror. So don't think that hacking phones is bad for your career. And I think the deputy of the Sunday People is Jamie Scott, Scotty. I've just had coming recently a source who is a private detective. He worked on a case in 1999 where he explained in court how he knew what he knew in a sort of commercial litigation battle because he'd hacked the voicemails. It wasn't actually illegal in 1999, by the way, so he could say that in court. Only when Reaper came in could you be done for intercepting communication in 2002. This fascinated the Telegraph, hacking into people's voicemails. So they called him into Canary Wharf to give a seminar on how to hack phones, because there are four different phone networks. You have to have a different PIN number for each one of them, and the standard factory setting isn't the same on all the different networks. The seminar was held at the Canary Wharf offices, was attended by a number of fascinated journalists, and I don't think this is hearsay, because he's got an invoice for which he was paid for that seminar. As I was speaking to someone at the Telegraph today, they said, that was four editors ago, and a different owner. But today, the editor is Tony Gallagher, who for 10 years sat on the Daily Mail's news desk. I remember the Daily Mail was the second biggest blagger of information, according to the Information Commissioner, procuring illegal information. He brought over from the Mail a few people, one of which was Gordon Rayner, who was a special investigations guy at the Mail. Quite competent journalist, very dogged investigator. I know that because he did me over when I got into a row with the Telegraph. And my admiration for him was such that he had all his details when they were doing a fetching profile, which brought a lot of information to my father-in-law that he wasn't previously aware of. out of professional admiration, because I won't say I'm naive in these things, I said, how did you get this, that, and the other? And he told me exactly how he got this, that, and the other. And he basically said he blagged it. They had a source inside an institution that they shouldn't have. He told me to my face that he'd illegally got the information. That was only in 2009. It isn't all over yet, is it? There's lots more to come, and all the papers are guilty. I don't think there's a single paper that is in the clear, and I include The Guardian. A famous leading journalist who's in the public eye at the moment gives a course at the Centre for Investigative Journalism at City. Never heard of them. At City University. In 2008, according to two different sources, he gave a talk on the ethics of phone hacking, where he explained to the assorted students how to do it. So I don't think anyone's going to be clean on this. I don't for a minute want to get too high on my horse, because obviously some of my best stories haven't been obtained perfectly to the happiness of my wife, who's a lawyer. Another point I'll just make on a totally different topic is that when we're talking about the problems with the politico-media nexus, I think the lobby system is 208 years overdue to be closed down. It's at the pinnacle of an implicit form of corruption. It is, imagine if they said, let's set up a secret organisation where the terms are that you can't tell anyone how it works, that if the Prime Minister says you're not allowed to say something, or the Prime Minister's staff say you're not allowed to say something, you're not allowed to say something. It's exclusive. No one is allowed to know how it works, what goes on, and that's called lobby terms. Imagine if they said that was going to be the thing that holds politicians to the account on behalf of the public. You'd laugh. But that is the system we have now. And a lot of people in the lobby say that it's past its day. But all these second-rate journalists kind of like the lobby system.
Okay, so quick sort of one-word answer, though. Following on that sort of bucket of filth that you describe, is it therefore time to get tough on those people? Do you welcome the idea, you know, instinctively, that they may actually have more oversight, and or actually does that go run against your instincts?
No. I think people who do criminal things should be done for doing criminal things. But I just think a little bit of hypocrisy makes the world go round a bit better.
Excellent. OK. Charlotte.
Oh, well, there's just so much I was going to say, and now I've just been so... I was already starstruck when we met in the green room. And
But you know Ulrika.
Yeah, well, I do. I do. I spoke to her this morning. She's my client. I'm going to get to the Ulrika thing, because we've already talked about it a bit, so I'm going to tell you about how that's going to be dealt with. The essential question, is it time to get tough? Well, you know, we kind of have. This time last week, I gave a talk at the Royal Institute where I said, oh, we're living in a meritocracy and he can't take over B Sky B, and who are these people who have hacked into, you know, Millie Dowler's telephone? We can't have this. And, you know, so much has happened in a week, it was almost pointless to try and prepare anything, because the news even today, and I understand why Martin is exhausted because he's been working really hard, but the news is moving so quickly. So all of us, I think, as citizens, as well as you know, lawyers or politicians, or I'm not sure what you are. You're pretty brilliant, though. We're all in the middle of at the moment, you know, a massive movement, a kind of crisis. Now, you know, what do I do, and what's my involvement in it? Yes, I'm just a lawyer, but this is my experience and how I feel at the moment. If that's of interest. 4 years ago, I was the assistant. The assistant on a case for Gordon Taylor. I just joined a new law firm in Manchester. I'd just come back off maternity leave, and there was this case about Gordon Taylor's name being read out in court as somebody else who'd been intercepted by Glenn Mulcair. Nobody seemed to care much about it. And Gordon Taylor happened to be a person in Manchester, the union boss, and the firm that I joined happened to be looking after him. And so I was really glad to be the assistant on this case. I had no idea at that point that it would end up like this. We went to see Gordon Taylor. We talked to lots of different barristers, and they said there's no evidence. We wrote to News of the World, and we said to News of the World, well, what is all of this? Can we have some evidence? What's been going on? And they said, you're barking up the wrong tree, and if you pursue this, then you're committing career suicide. And you know, I kind of believed it, because I think that as a reasonable person, you don't think that this has happened. And certainly up until January this year, when I became aware of the victims of crime, and that's when I first became aware of the hacking into the telephones of kids who had gone missing or been murdered. Even up until January this year, I still thought that it was salacious stories trying to get, you know, politicians to account for themselves and celebrities. So that naivety hadn't left me, you know, even up until now. So I'm genuinely shocked. We did this case, and the police eventually gave us some disclosure. The disclosure is the random stuff that happened to be picked up at the private investigator's property 4 years before, at the time, to, you know, and it was what it was. We looked at the disclosure. It was quite clear that others at News of the World were involved, and surprise, surprise, the case settled. And I kind of thought that was the end of it. But even then, I still didn't realise the full impact. I had no idea how many victims there might be. It just looked like there was, you know, more than just the princes. When the settlement, the huge settlement, got exposed in The Guardian a year later, and I found myself doing my first ever independent case on my own. It was the first case I'd ever done as a partner. I don't even think I was a partner then. I joined a different law firm. It was Max Clifford's case. So up until then, never done anything like this. It's a big first one to have. So I went to see Max. He said, all right, pop it. And I said, all right. And he said, right, I'm going to take them on. I'm not scared of anyone. So, you know, I thought, well, I didn't really even then think that there was something to be scared of. This time, taking on this case was different because I had some idea of what happened up until getting the evidence, but it was a police position that changed. When we came to the stage where we asked for disclosure, like we'd done in the Gordon Taylor case, the disclosure arrived, but this time the names had all been blanked out. And so I sort of wrote to the police, I said, come on, you know, is it a mistake? Like, who blanked out the names in the top left-hand corner of the journalists who were involved? And they said, well, we're protecting their privacy. I said, I'm making an application. This is outrageous. So, you know, Max loved it. You know, he's like, ah. Oh. So we go to court. We have this, there was some press there. Nick Davis, a journalist, was obviously interested. But again, as soon as we got into the position where the documents were going to be unredacted, and I could then again see that there were all these other names, but they wouldn't tell me who the names were. Basically, the document that you, the typical document that you get is a piece of paper. I'll just show you like this. You might not know. Piece of paper, commissioning journalist, top left-hand corner, and then things like account details, telephone numbers, sometimes some notes about the story, but all in, like, you know, note form. And so you'd have to really go through it. So if you could imagine that piece of paper having your client's name and everything else blacked out, that's like, you know, tell it to the judge. Anyway, so we did tell it to the judge, and the judge said don't be ridiculous, you know. And then the case settled. And so for, you know, reportedly a very large sum of money. And then everything went a bit quiet again. And then suddenly the cases started, and more people started to take cases on, and the whole movement began to grow. And every step of the way, it was like getting blood out of a stone. And it was a massive learning curve for me as a lawyer, because, you know, there are many things that are quite frightening. And I said, you kind of expect to trust the original police investigation. You don't expect them to say to you that... you don't expect them not to have notified victims. You don't expect them to redact evidence. You don't expect the other side to say, it's one rogue. And we have moved from one rogue reporter now to one rogue newspaper. And so you don't expect that to continue to be peddled if it's not true. And you expect the lawmakers in the country to be supportive. And it's quite frightening being up against that. And so whilst I know that the News of the World last week, you know, on the Thursday announced that they were going to shut down, it didn't feel, having, you know, with the Millie Dowler story being exposed, like a massive victory. It actually just felt like, you know, standing on a battlefield and looking around and just thinking, oh my God, couldn't you just not have done that? Couldn't you just have sorted your act out and told us the truth? Couldn't you just have cleaned it up? I don't want to have a situation when you say, do you know what, right, we're going, and that's it. Because it's a bit like having a, you know, a sort of villainous husband who you want to change. And, you know, I do sort of, you know, I feel an odd sense of sorrow that they've shut down. They've been my opponent for so many years. I wanted him to change, if you can imagine it that way. And instead, he just upped and left.
Michelle, when you describe that, in a sense, I wonder what,
are you
describing the triumph of the law, or are you describing, are you warning really that never mind the regulatory systems, it's the problem is that that when institutions like police, politicians combined with media, that any kind of regulation is not going to be effective?
I don't know whether any regulation is going to be totally effective until we change what we ask journalists to do and how their practice is. I mean, obviously, we need to make sure that regulators have got some teeth, but we don't even quite know the monster that we're dealing with. What Guido was saying about Ulrika, just to quickly address that, and the reason why I've talked...
Go on, Janita.
Only very quickly.
Go on then.
The reason why I mentioned what I have done about the forensic evidence is because you can't take a case without forensic evidence. Whatever anyone says about that, you know, that's, you know, rumours that go around, it's not enough. And so I've not seen evidence that could be used in court against another newspaper, and you have to be very careful not to go forward with legal cases unless you have that evidence. And with the News of the World, we did have it eventually, and it took that long. So, you know, we have to be careful.
Great. Thanks very much, Charlotte. David.
When Charlie said, off the back of column writing today, which is what I've been doing, come and take part in a debate, in a way you think to yourself, well, where on earth are we going to start with this? We've now covered three, maybe more, sort of discrete parts of areas of the story, and we haven't even begun to look at it in its totality, or indeed its context. That's no criticism of anybody. That just gives you an idea of the scope of what we're dealing with. What I've written today, and I think I might just as well kind of start there, because I think I see this as part, actually, this latest scandal and the reaction to it as really the latest phenomena in what has been a very long-term and now accelerating process of the institutions of the establishment coming under scrutiny. And although that scrutiny is now intense and increases, I think we still don't know what to do, and this is what I've written, about what it is that we discover as a result. In other words, we are better informed and becoming better informed than we've ever been before, but it isn't necessarily clear what it is that you do with that information for the best. And one of the problems within the context of a firestorm is, as I started the comment by saying, is it's often it's actually the worst place to start thinking, largely because you begin to, all kinds of things get chucked into the pot. They're all mixed up together. They're mixed up together with a kind of level of hyperbole, and also the kind of suggestion, and I think this is the point Paul was also partially making, that everything is somehow new, when in fact what you're dealing with is a whole lot of things that are extremely old. I mean, one of the things that we've discussed here, for instance, we've touched on, is the question of legality and ethics. Now, when I came into journalism through broadcasting, through high-end subsidised journalism, first in the ITV, and then, though BBC people don't like to admit it, in the BBC. High-end journalism, which is still a kind of relatively minority thing within the BBC, is subsidised. If you ask the controller of BBC One, who have continuously argued to try and get current affairs off their channel and onto something else, you'll be left under no doubt as to how that's regarded. So I had always taken the view, once I left the BBC, where there was this great set of documents called the Producer's Guidelines that governed all kinds of situations, including most of the forms of investigative reporting we could be talking about, secret filming and so on. I came out after the best part of 6 years of an intense journalistic discussion about ethics to work for a newspaper, The Independent, where there was no discussion about ethics at all, and where increasingly you wouldn't get a discussion about ethics. One of the things I find very interesting about what's happening at City University, LSE and other places is that I think the media studies is now beginning to re-inject the discussion about ethics into the system. And that's actually, funnily enough, I think that's one of the reasons why we're beginning to get this form of scrutiny now, is actually people coming forward who are sufficiently media savvy to understand what's going on, to ask themselves whether or not it's necessary. When I came into the newspapers, what I discovered essentially was, and incidentally, if your ethics aren't there, then the legality isn't going to matter. It is quite interesting, isn't it, to think that somehow or other we regard phone hacking as being perfectly proper up until the point when the law made it illegal. Well, it wasn't proper. It was unethical. You wouldn't have been allowed to do it inside the BBC. But one of the reasons why papers thought they had to do it, and not just newspapers either, magazines and so on, they thought they had to do it, was, as Paul Dacre famously said in his 2008 lecture to the Society of Editors, these newspapers exist on the basis of sensation, on the basis of stories that people want to see. You know what the Ulrika story was, however, got? It was the perfect story. I wrote it at the time. I remember writing that line. I said, I do not like this kind of story, but even I have to admit, this is the perfect story. Nobody is not going to read it. And do you know what? Nobody cared where it came from, whether it was legal, illegal, hacked, not hacked. They didn't care until the Millie Dowler story came about, which is why this firestorm came about. But actually, you've lost the ethical past long before you ever came to the Millie. The Millie Dowler thing is engendered by the Ulrika Jonsson thing. And your response, my response, readers' responses, etc. to that story is what engendered in the end something like the Millie Dowell. Now, I have to say, even in that case, I cannot comprehend what the reasoning about that particular one is. But that kind of case, for instance. So, that's the problem of ethics. So the ethics are now under greater scrutiny, which therefore raises the question of Parliament and regulation. And of course, the last great scandal was MPs' expenses. And for those of us who can enjoy schadenfreude, even when it's our own expense, you can see it in spades in the House of Commons today. They couldn't get everybody, they can't get the Telegraph, they can't get the Mail, they can't get the others, but they can sure as hell get News International. And there is an awful lot of revenge going on when it's going down in the House of Commons today. These journalists, these other people, they've got too powerful, but actually MPs are also at the long end of a great secular trend towards much greater scrutiny. You can see that in the Quangos. You can see that in the bodies they've had to set up to regulate their own expenses. You can see that in the Office for Budgetary Responsibility, which then tells the government what it can and can't do. You can see it in the Independent Statistics Authority, which now reprimands the government when the government gets the statistics wrong. As I put in my piece this morning, can you imagine Winston Churchill being told that he has to make a note every time he meets Lord Beaverbrook? And have it published every 4 weeks. He would have found it absolutely extraordinary. So we then move on. So from regulation, I don't think that regulation is actually the issue, funnily enough. And they will sweat over this one for hither and yon. I think ethics is the issue, and whether or not we police ethics properly, and the way in which we police ethics properly is by people responding to what they regard as unethical conduct. And if they don't, it won't change, and if they do, then it will change. And that's broadly how it is. And I think that probably puts me roughly where you are, funnily enough, slightly on the sort of anarchist and where people will be. Though I want to say one final thing, therefore, about collateral in this. Because we are now in this kind of strange situation, the collateral about this is now the question of media ownership. Actually, this isn't a debate about media ownership. This has now become a discussion about media influence in society and so on. But the actual truth about the mainstream media, particularly newspapers, is that they are more enfeebled than they have ever been. Even The Guardian, on the back of the WikiLeaks year, dropped 12.5% in readership and now finds its website cannibalising its free websites and the internet cannibalising its printed edition. And it can't go on. And actually very few people can go on unless they have access to a significant amount of cross-funding. So one of the possible collabs, thinking about this today, if it turns out to be true, which I think it won't, if, as a consequence of this, Murdoch does decide to get rid of the News International titles in Britain, I cannot see a long-term future for the quality press in Britain. I think we will come down in much the same way as it has in the States. The States has already lost newspapers in the most kind of incredible way. That would be the most amazing piece of collateral damage as a consequence of this. I don't forecast it, but I think it is actually a possibility. And having kind of, you know, dropped that bomb, I think I'll stop.
Yeah. just pursue a little bit, David. In your last column, you were kind of, not only were you sort of sympathetic with Paul Staines, but you were sympathetic with Paul Dacre. And you were kind of making the Dacre argument that somehow there was something, or at least you were toying with it. You were with this argument that somehow the newspapers need to be able to transgress or mix up in a unique way. And yet, as a former broadcaster, as you said, that people... The BBC people don't necessarily not transgress because of the producer guidelines. Isn't there a kind of cultural ethics? I wonder if, you know, do you want both?
No, I mean, I can't tell you how often BBC investigative journalists wished to transgress the producer guidelines. Mm. You know that because you were on one of the family of current affairs programmes that we produced. From Panorama, while you were there, they would regularly come in and say, look, we want to do some secret filming. And you'd say, OK, but the rules for secret filming are that you cannot get this information in any other way because you're using a subterfuge, and B, that this isn't just some kind of fishing expedition, that you actually have some kind of prima facie evidence upon which you can base this. And C, really, that the story is big enough, it's proportional.
But you,
do you think, though, therefore, why not just apply that to newspapers?
Well, why not create the producer guidelines for newspapers? When they have their panel for ethics, one of the things, the first things that they will do, if they're any good, is they will start asking themselves precisely that question. Why don't we just say, get rid of the PCC, which is an utterly useless organisation. I mean, an organisation beyond uselessness in every possible way. Why don't we just have a situation whereby we say, we expect your journalists to subscribe to that? Well, who's going to enforce it? The BBC enforces it because it chooses to, and also because if it didn't enforce it, it would get into all kinds of rows. When John Burt took over as the head of journalism at the BBC, it was in response to a series of arguments which had happened, including the way in which Panorama had a habit of stitching up interviewees and so on. And so it was decided to be harder about what the producer guidelines were and to have them harder. A lot of people complained, a lot of people didn't like it. Can you imagine that being done in the newspaper industry? And then you get the big dichotomy, and of course this is the thing that came through in the injunctions question. You get the big dichotomy is, what are you going to do if you've got an incredibly lively and anarchic, non-regulated internet sector that's doing whatever the heck it likes, and your journalists turn and actually breaking stories as a consequence? Do you repeat the stories that they break, despite the fact that they've been got in this sort of nefarious and unproducer-guidelined way? Are you not going to read these stories? You're going to say, when you look at these stories, you see they come from Gein or somebody else, and say, I'm not going to read that because I have a suspicion it was got unethically, so I'm not going to read it. Yeah. Or are you going to go to the website, click on it, give him another hit or another million hits, see his advertisers, see a little bit kind of roll in or whatever, and keep him going, or whoever bankrolls him?
Excellent. Okay, I'm going to throw it open and take questions. But just following up on that idea, should newspapers have sort of BBC producer guidelines? And of course they do. By the way, we did ask the PCC to speak here. They do, of course, have the editor's code. And I do happen to have Mr. Bob Satchwell from the Society of Editors. So, Bob, do you want to stand up even? Just sort of, do you want to address that one? I mean,
yeah, happy to do that.
Sorry, we've got a microphone, please. Thanks.
Can I just say first, though, that I mean, David is absolutely right that the worst place to start on this is in the middle of this firestorm, and that's been the huge problem that I've been sort of trying to deal with over the last 10 days. And the worst bit was when the Prime Minister stood up and said we're going to have this inquiry, but this is what it's going to decide. You've got to get rid of the PCC. Some of us don't have quite the same view of the PCC as David, but also that every paper in the country is bad news. And I think the problem is that we need now, particularly now we've got one of the political parts of this story out of the way, now that Murdoch has withdrawn his application for BSkyB, we can put that on one side. We can just sit down and try and be a bit cool about it. The producers' guidelines, the BBC producers' guidelines, an interesting thought. In fact, we had our board meeting this afternoon. Our board has on it representatives from papers from as wide apart as Yorkshire, the Yorkshire Post, down to the Western Morning Mail, and some weekly papers in between, the BBC and Sky Television, and the Sun, and finally the Methodist Recorder. Now, quite a diverse board, you will see, but the one point that we all agreed on was that we've got to avoid there being some kind of statutory form of regulation. Make sure that whatever is put in the place of the present system, it has to come from within. And in a sense, I'm agreeing totally with David on that point, that's it's got to come from within. Whether it's a producer's guidelines issue or some other form of guidelines and expansion of the editor's code, which is there now, and indeed within papers themselves. And it is up to papers within themselves to take action with people that they find who are doing things which are unethical. I mean, I don't think that the phone hacking bit, you know, is dealt with by the law, and journalists shouldn't break the law, except where there might, in some parts of the law, where there is a public interest defence available and they find a public interest defence. But the basic point is that this has got to be done from within the industry. And the answer to the question you've posed tonight, phone hacking, is it time to get tough on the press? Bear in mind that something like nearly 200 years ago now, I think the Duke of Wellington said, publish and be damned, when he was about to be exposed. Well, what we've found at the moment is that certainly one newspaper group has certainly published and been very heavily damned to the tune of quite a few millions of pounds. And we've lost one paper with a long and proud history, actually. It did lots of things, apart from the titillation, which was always good fun, and apart from the entertainment value of it. There are a huge number of stories which it did, which no one would argue weren't in the public interest. And we've got to avoid that. There is a problem about unintended consequences that we've got to deal with. I don't think anyone intended that we should lose a paper, and I hope that no one intends that we should lose a free press. And what you've got to remember there is that if you want a free press, you can't only have a free press of the kind that you like and agree with. If you want a free press, it's got to be some warts and all.
Great, thank you very much, Bob. What I'm going to do is I'm going to sort of take groups of three questions, because I suspect there's quite a lot of people who ask them. So put your hands up and let's start. The gentleman there in the red. Where are the other microphones have I got?
I've got two here.
Oh, you've got one there. All right, yeah. Wait your turn, either. Let's hurtle it right into the midst there, that woman in the middle, please. And have we got one upstairs? Who's got a microphone upstairs, have we? Yeah, come on. Lady down the front there, please. Go, man in red.
Hi, I'm not a press person or a lawyer, but I'm always thinking about the press as being a corporate body as well, by and large. And I think the questions you want to ask about focusing on press, but also corporate, I think you'd have to question the corporate ethics if you've got an aspect of that corporation going for information no matter how. How are they dealing with their corporate takeovers, their influence in the markets, etc.? Is it the same ethics that apply to the journalist aspect of that corporation as it would to their commercial dealings?
Good one. In the middle.
Oh, hi. I work for an Indian financial daily and obviously been reading a lot about the international coverage. And I think there has been a lot of schadenfreude among the press as well. You know, other countries saying, well, you know, look at the British press, they've always claimed to be that great, and look at the situation now. Do you think there's something specific about the conditions in Britain that have kind of created this crisis, or do you think it's something that happens elsewhere?
That's a good question, please. And then at the top.
Yes, Margaret Cooper, Media International. Just wondering regarding phone hacking. Nothing has been brought up regarding the middle persons who actually get to sell the stories and whom to hack. And why is it going to be used as a bartering situation, all the dirt that's been accumulated by the News of the World and then been transferred over to people like Max Clifford?
Okay. David, do you want to kick off? Especially picking corporate ethics.
Well, on corporate ethics and corporate legality is strictly regulated, so it's not the same kind of thing as press ethics. As we see, this actually does all I think what's more interesting in a way, because this goes back to my scrutiny point, was for a long time, large parts of Britain, Britain particularly as a society, less known in the States, simply wasn't open to scrutiny. It just wasn't. There was a day when if a policeman hit you on a demonstration, he would then charge you with assault, run you up before the magistrates, who would say the policeman says X, therefore it must be true, and fine you. And that was largely, through the kind of large parts of Britain, that's how British society, large parts of it, kind of operated. And people didn't object to that too much, providing it didn't get too much on everybody's nerves and so on. We have moved well beyond that. As I said, we've moved into a completely different kind of society with regard to how we look at people. And therefore, the things that people have been able to do, they are no longer able to do. So one of the things that is interesting is News International's response to the accusations of phone hacking, as far as I understand it, and I have to be careful here because there are an awful lot of accusations flying around, some of which don't have much evidence about who knew what, but I think it smacks of a desire simply to bury it. simply to bear it and to answer as few questions you possibly could and not to be there and not to give an account of yourself. I think that was a huge mistake for them. Look, quite apart from the rights and the wrongs, it was a huge mistake for them because all the trend is in the opposite direction, the trend of people that people have a desire for. I just wanted to simply say on the middle person's question, I don't want to say any more. I'll let somebody else do it.
Martin.
On the first and second question, the corporate ethics, we've spent quite a lot of time this week going around the party leaders and some leading parliamentarians going through the terms of reference of the inquiry. And one of the specific things we've talked about, which was not really talked about at all last week, is the whole issue of corporate governance for the very reason that you say, which is that our belief is that you can't just look at the newsroom here, and in particular in the case of News International, you have to look more broadly at the corporate governance issues and what failures there were that meant that this organisation was incredibly, and it's internally unaccountable, so much so that the whole issue, the rather remarkable letter that James Murdoch sent about the evidence that he gave the select committees about his involvement in the signing off the payment to Gordon Taylor's allegedly £700,000 payment. So the corporate governance issues surrounding how that organisation got to that position, I think is central. On the UK specific question, Michael Shudson, I think it was last year, Michael Shudson wrote a book called Why Democracies Need an Unlovable Press, and I think he's right. I think he's absolutely right. I just think an unlovable press in America is a very different type of unlovable press than the British. I think our press is distinctly unlovable, sometimes in a genuinely good way, but I think in the last week we've seen that there are aspects of the British press that are so unlovable they don't just do damage to democracy, they do damage to an awful lot of ordinary people.
Shauna?
I'm going to go for the middlemen question on the basis of, as I've just told you, I looked after Max Clifford, and so I understand a little bit. Just in case I get it wrong, do you mean things such as the PR guys and so on? So the lady who asked the question, just so I...
It seems pretty obvious. This situation is an accumulation of collected dirt... Mm-hmm. on particular MPs and people of influence and how to actually profit from it in a different company title.
Well, look, one of the things that we've talked about a lot recently is privacy and privacy injunctions, and this is how I see it connect. I think there was quite a big verdict from the sort of general voice of the public that said, look, we want wrongdoing exposed. And up until really the last couple of weeks, certainly when I've talked about it in public, I've had people putting up their hands and saying, look, we pay the footballers, we pay the politicians, they don't pay the footballers, they just said that, and I never understood it. And if they've done some wrongdoing, if you don't want it exposed, then don't do it. Now, nobody's taken out an injunction, and I certainly haven't sought to get one for weeks now. Nobody wants to be the first person. So what's left is the middlemen. Because now, if somebody comes to you and there's a breach of privacy, however it's happened, a threat of a story, I'm going to sell this story about this relationship that we've had unless you give me 40 grand. And that's actually, I think 80% of the time, that is a specific thing that I have to deal with. Now that we can't say, OK, let's go and get an injunction, what we have is the middlemen, such as the PRs coming in and trading with the different newspapers, because I can't slam an injunction on anymore and say, look, it's private, you can't publish it, tough. We're back to pre-injunction times. So one of the ways the law's going is actually helping the middlemen. Other types of middlemen, private detectives, for instance. I hope this is answering your question correctly, because I'm not sure it is. In America, as I understand it, this is something that Phil Hall, the ex-editor of the News of the World, he's a PR man now, and he was talking to me about this last week. He said, why is no one talking about the regulation of private detectives? like they have in America? Why in this country is it all right just to set up a private detective agency? And obviously if people break the law and you find out, but they don't have to keep records and so on. So that's something to think about as well. There's a lot of trading that goes on, but at the moment we don't have a system in place that's dealing with everybody, and it's very easy to throw blame in one direction.
Okay, Paul.
On the just the last point about private detectives, quietly the Met has put a lot of pressure on the usual private detectives to give it a rest, and my understanding is a lot of private detectives are giving it a rest at the moment. Max Clifford adds to the gaiety of the world. He's a fundamentally good thing. He's an equaliser. If you have just shagged a horrible footballer and you go off to the News of the World, News of the World will say, well, posing lingerie and we'll give you 500 quid. Max Clifford gets you 50 grand. He equals the score for people. He's a fundamentally good thing. So, he's actually a commercial rival of mine, so I don't know why I'm bigging him up. The British press being raucous, it's great, isn't it?
Okay. I have to say, having done countless interviews with sort of international media, you sort of, when you're being read, you know, rung up by Zimbabweans and French people, you still think, you know, your press isn't perfect either.
We didn't answer the international, the international point, and do you know why? Because we just don't know enough about how it is in other countries to be able to make that comparison on this panel. That's my feeling, and I apologise for that. That's the honest answer.
Okay, so let's take some more. Let's wind our way from there. And can you bring in the lady at the back, two back, and let's grab one at the top. Do you want to head the other way? Can you go the other side? Take the first one down here. Go, Ivor.
Hi, thanks. I'm Ivor Gaber from City University and Bedfordshire University. I wanted to pick up Bob's point on regulation, because up until, and there hasn't been much discussion of it, but up until about a week ago, I would have agreed with him that self-regulation was the goal, was the gold standard. But it hasn't worked, that's quite clear. And if we look across at broadcasting, for all their shortcomings, it seems to me that BBC Trust and Ofcom do a decent job at regulating broadcasting. Of course, people then say statutory, this is government interference, but actually, there's a parliament, and it controls these things. And if we don't have any faith in the parliament, and I know people don't, but actually that's the basis of our democratic system. So it seems to me that it's not a perfect system. It would have been nice if self-regulation had worked, but it hasn't. And I think the time has come to look at the broadcasting model and introduce it for the press, unless we can come up with a better system.
Okay, broadcasting model then, please.
Yes, my name is Danielle Anaj. I teach law at Westminster. What amazes me in this whole story, I'm neither a journalist nor involved in any sort of press-related activities, but what I find amazing is that we have such an obvious situation where an editor, or now head of a news corporation, is flaunted around as good mates with Rupert Murdoch, where there's, it seems, no conflict of interest in that alone. I mean, where is that? I mean, where is any opposition to that? I mean, why have we reached a situation where it's perfectly acceptable for an editor or former editor of a large news organization to be good friends with the proprietor, with the owner of the organization? I find that outrageous. And also, if you could perhaps give me an indication of what you think that might mean for David Cameron and some of his inner circle, who are very clearly implicated in this whole story because of their very close links to the Murdoch press.
Okay.
Do you mean Prime Minister, not proprietor?
No, I meant proprietor, as in Rupert Murdoch. I mean, why have we reached a situation where...
Do you think it's bad for an editor to be friendly with his boss? Is that what you're saying?
No, what I'm saying is, how come, I mean, if Rebecca Brooks wanted to take an independent line to Murdoch, it seems that that would have been unacceptable, given their close relationship. And what does that mean for free speech, essentially?
Okay, and then at the top, who's got the microphone?
Yeah. Could I ask a similar question following on from that? Can we not think about regulation of ownership again? I think, like Charlotte, I was a bit shocked when I read in the weekend that Murdoch, who's not even a taxpayer, he rings up Blair three times 10 days before the invasion of Iraq. Is it right that one man can do this, the owner of a newspaper? Can we not sort of think about newspapers not being owned by one individual anymore?
Okay, well, that's some, there's sort of two there, aren't there? Two big ones on brought back to broadcasting, but also the ownership, proprietorial relationship. Is there anything realistically that can be done about that? David, do you chat much to Rupert? Or?
No, I've never met him actually, but sort of some of the people around me have, when he sort of makes his famous visits into London. And he is a presence, but of course it's not the kind of clunk-click presence which is sort of implied by the question. Rupert comes in, lays down the line. It just doesn't happen like that. However, it is certainly true that editors have an impression of what he thinks about something like Europe. I think that's almost the only subject. I mean, it isn't true that the Times decided to go for Cameron because Rupert told them to. They decided to go to Cameron because any fool could see that Brown's was a clapped out government. I've voted Labour, I'm a Labour Party member and so on, but that by and large was, you know, was not an unfair perception for most newspapers or anybody else to come to. It just doesn't work like that. Now you're asking us, so I think your question is not wrong and so on. All I can say is it's in a sense always been that way. And this goes back to this question of ownership. I would also love to see a series of independent, beautifully run newspaper cooperatives where we would all get together and we'd all put in a pound and we'd all kind of run the thing, etc. And all the stories would be ethical and everybody would shell out their money for it and these things would still exist.
Well, we did that, didn't we? The News on Sunday?
Yeah, we had the News on Sunday. The News on Sunday. Was that what it was called? It was not The Correspondent. Was it The Correspondent?
News on Sunday, wasn't it?
The News on Sunday, that's right. Unfortunately, and it's the same is true to a certain extent of football clubs, absent somebody with a significant amount of money to try and give you the lift and with an interest in newspapers, it isn't going to happen. The Independent is now run by an ex-KGB oligarch, etc. Now, he may be a really good ex-KGB oligarch who seems to have given the Independent to his son as a kind of present. And again, this son seems to be, from what I'm told by independent journalists, a very good person. That was bought from Tony O'Reilly, who took it over from the appalling nexus of ownership with the Mirror Group and a series of European titles, none of whom could put any investment in the paper because they were all losing money themselves, and some of whom I think have now gone. So that gives you an idea. The Express is owned by a pornographer. The Express titles, Richard Desmond, who did have the proper fitness test passed upon him, and if Richard Desmond passes the fit and proper person test, then who the hell is going to fail it? So then you have the FT, the Financial Times, and arguably the Guardian model. What I've already said to you, the Guardian model, which has actually essentially, after it relaunched with the Berlin, an incredibly expensive and bold investment in a new size of newspaper, and the readers rewarded it by refusing to buy the paper in droves and so on, and by, as I said, taking it online, has actually survived largely because of its connections with other publications that have nothing to do with the world of journalists. So I put it to you, it's that way or it's no way. You can have as many kind of fabulous castles in the air as you want. There's one chap who's been tweeting around saying, how about getting rid of the criminal syndicate? Because we're not now just people who've done things wrong. We are now the Sopranos, right? And so we're all kind of involved. And selling the Times off to somebody else. So I just put in and said, okay, great idea. Who? And he said, are you really saying that there's no one that's not a criminal who's not willing to take on the Times? And I thought about this, I said, probably not, no. I mean, given that he's a socialist worker supporter, not in your sense, probably not. And so on. So, like with everything else, this question of ownership is much more vexed than some people like to. So what actually a print journalist looks for is a berth in an organisation that has some kind of deep pockets to invest in the journalism and that doesn't interfere too much. And by and large, most of us get that. Okay. What hasn't been open is our processes. That's not been open. They have been forms of trade secrets which we've kept. I say less me than most other people, incidentally, because I've always been open about these things. But as we have kept these trade secrets, as the police have kept theirs, and as civil servants have kept theirs, and so on. Well, guess what? It's all opening up now. That's good. It's absolutely excellent, and the Guardian's played a major role in making it sure that happens in this part of the sector. But you have to follow on from that and say what therefore happens as a consequence. What you don't want is a whole lot of collateral, which means that you don't have anything to scrutinise.
Yeah. And I guess part of the opening up is the story that everyone's forgotten about now is Johan Pari, who's been subject to a sort of transparency exercise, isn't he?
Yeah, Johan has. I have to say that Johan is a friend of mine, and so I'm in a sort of deeply compromised position when talking about it. I have to say, however, one of the things, I will say this, one of the things I dislike most about the British press, if we're talking about it, is its deeply punitive attitude towards other people's wrongdoing, and its deeply forgiving attitude towards its own. But it's deeply, and it's part of a punitive attitude. Somebody like Johan has done, in my opinion, an unethical thing, and has done it wrongly, and I think has done it at a time, over time, of personal vulnerability. But I know that to be the case.
His whole career was vulnerability.
No, it's not his whole career.
Yeah, I mean, it's not going.
No,
to
but anyway,
goes,
but
it goes back to varsity.
Yeah. But anyway, no, I'm aware.
Paul,
I mean,
do you want to pick up on the especially going? Sorry, I don't want to. Do you ever talk to your proprietor?
Sometimes.
Does it make any sense?
I think I might get locked up if I'd be mad when I talk to myself.
The shaving mirror.
Ivor asked a question about regulation and how he switched towards regulation. I would have thought that regulation would be the death knell of the newspapers because we wouldn't have as much news in them that would be entertaining. I think Dacre's 2008 speech, I didn't quite catch whether David was appalled by it or enthralled by it.
Interested by it.
I think Dacre's analysis is fundamentally correct on this. If you don't have entertaining infotainment in newspapers, people won't buy them. I rest my case by pointing to The Guardian.
They do the G2 bit with all the... You know.
Oh yeah, but actually they do have some insane stuff. It's probably keeping them going.
Yeah.
The indie, though, you know.
Yeah, okay. Martin.
To Ivor, I'm sorry Bob's left actually because Bob said this is a matter for the police, the police need to deal with this. I wrote a letter to the Times in October 2006. It was just after the Information Commissioner's first report saying this is significant, this is serious, this needs to be, someone needs to look at this and think about this. It was published in the Times. Next day, there was a letter published in the Times by Sir Christopher Mayer saying, you don't know what you're talking about, you're naive, this is a police matter, we will look at this after the police have finished going through it. The police did finish going through it. The Information Commissioner went to see the PCC, said, this is quite serious, you ought to look at this. They said, actually, no, we think it's already been dealt with by the police, thank you very much. As I mentioned earlier, 2.5 years ago, we published a report which was very critical of the PCC. The report was, it didn't excite many much popularity. And that wasn't just in terms of the press. There were an awful lot of people in the press who were very negative about it. But when we were looking for some support for the criticisms that we were making and saying that reform needed to happen, things needed to be changed, we also looked across the board at politicians and things. We got some support behind the scenes, but generally we're told this is toxic, don't touch it. And people walked away. I think one of the things that we've done in the last sort of week and a half, and it's been quite interesting conversations, and very interesting conversations, but one of the things that we've done is to say, almost all the terms of reference and the discussions about the inquiry were about the press, and we have to sort out the press. And we said, this is not just about the press. I mean, and it's not just about the police and allegations of payments and stuff like that. If the terms of reference in this public inquiry doesn't also include the relationship between the press and the politicians, and why the politicians have been scared to do things about the press, why the politicians have been scared to talk about these issues, then we're not going to get the cultural change that you're talking about. We're not going to get sort of a different press, and we're not going to get we're going to get a reversion. Someone said to me earlier this week, they said, so yeah, but how about Diana? How about Diana? That was what, 2 weeks, 4 weeks hiatus?
And it was a very intense period of time. And then how long was it after that before the Daily Mail started hiring paparazzi again? I think part of the reason why, and I apologize for my rambling, I'm slightly tired, I haven't had much sleep in the last week or so, but part of the reason why I think, or I hope at least, the public inquiry will have a positive impact is because it's supposed to be a cathartic process. It's supposed to get things out into the open over a prolonged period of time. Because if this just is a frenzy that lasts 2-3 weeks, if this just is sort of a momentous moment, and it does lead to whatever some cutting off of the knees of Murdoch and B-Sky B, then it won't fundamentally have changed things, and it needs to fundamentally change. So that's what I hope, at least, the public inquiry will start to do.
Thanks, Martin.
Charlie. Just very quickly, on the question about Mr. Murdoch being able to just call up the Prime Minister. A lot's been said about the responsibilities of newspapers, but we've also got to see what we can do as people. And one of the things we've got to do is demand from our politicians that they're braver. We've got to be very aware of newspaper propaganda that's self-serving. We've got to be less accepting very quickly of the sort of campaigns that led to it. I remember watching the parliamentary debates where various politicians were saying, we've looked into it, that's the end of it. We have to continue to be critical if you have a situation where, for instance, Annie Coulson was allowed to come into government. So, we have to, now that this has happened and there's been this punishment, rightly, on the News of the World, we've now got to keep the pressure up for all newspapers, the politicians, the people, and so on.
Excellent. All right, thank you, Charlotte. Let's take another round. I'm going to start. I've surreptitiously got microphones here and here. Let's take you, please, first.
It's Anthony Painter. Because of the opening up that David describes, it's quite clear that unethical behaviour has become a significant reputational and business risk. So what I'm interested in, putting regulation to one side and inquiries, how do you think the behaviours of journalists and editors will actually change in response to this situation?
Good question. Please, say who you are, please.
Hi, my name's Paul Dadge, and I was involved in the terrorist attacks on the 7th of July in London. And I'm sitting here kind of sweating, my palms are sweating because I've got something I want to say, but I'm kind of scared to say it because of the repercussions of... So I won't name any newspapers, as Paul probably would, but I was contacted a year after the bombings by a newspaper, we'll call them Newspaper X, with regard to my criminal record. To clarify, I do not have a criminal record. But there was an alleged story that I had a criminal record, and I was asked about this on the telephone by a journalist. And when I categorically told them that the story didn't exist, I was told that, and pretty much in threatening terms, that if I didn't have this conversation and didn't tell them what my criminal record was, they would go to their police informants and get the information. And for that person to be that flippant on a telephone conversation with me kind of shows what a widespread issue this is. And just to end that with a question, why has it taken 6 years for us to be in this position that we're in now, that for me was no surprise that this situation we're in now has happened 5 years previous?
Thank you. And there was one at the back.
Graham Frost. I wanted to pick up on David Aronovich's point about the possible loss of the whole of the titles in the UK of News International. It's entirely possible that we could end up in a situation where the balls are cut off the press as a result of these changes. The idea of regulation by a method that is similar to the BBC's producer guidelines has been mentioned. I mean, I do stuff at the BBC, so obviously I'm thinking about that. The fact is, the BBC gets an awful lot of funding. So is this a period not only to look at supplying a whip for the press, but also supplying some more carrots, maybe looking at ways of being able to provide more subsidy, possibly through the form of advertising or changes to VAT and so on, that in some way is going to keep the British press healthy.
Excellent. I'm going to take one more bonus question.
Yes, in my understanding of British law, it appears that where a newspaper is closed down, its assets are transferred to a liquidator. Could it not well be that the liquidator decides that rather than fighting and defending claims against phone hacking, it decides to destroy the material and simply default on these claims? That was a concern raised by a Labour Member of Parliament. What does the panel think? Is there a chance that Rupert Murdoch is using the closure of the News of the World as a cover-up for his illegal practices?
Okay, I'm sure Charlotte can tell you. Healthy mix. Who wants to start?
On that last point, it's just factually doesn't make any sense. It's not closing company. It's closing down the title. The company still exists. So that doesn't apply, and even if they did, there would be loads of... reasons why they couldn't just destroy the evidence in the course of a police investigation.
What do you to pick on the other one? What do you think it would take to make the ethical behaviour of the people that you work so closely with?
The feedback I'm getting from everybody is, you know, we're all at it. You know, it's not just us; it's them, and you know, everyone's pointing fingers everywhere. And how the hell are we going to get any bloody stories? Well, if they want white blank pages in the newspapers, etc., etc. So I just think what will happen now is the go-getter, the people who have the drive to go get stories, just will definitely not tell their superiors how they got them. And I just can't see how in a competitive newspaper world, people will be restrained, apart from fear of going to jail, from breaking. I think it's a misunderstanding of human nature. So I don't really, I mean, all the regulations work and everyone's good, and I'll be a lot more successful and have much better stories.
David?
The reporter who contacted you must have thought that the story that you had a criminal record would be one that readers wanted to read. It seems to me, I don't want to, was it him or her, a him? It was a him. I don't want to kind of let that person off the hook at all. I mean, I think that people will convince themselves in institutions that a practice is okay, which they would have immense difficulty in explaining to their own family. And I think when you're in that situation, when you can't explain it to your own family, then you're in ethical trouble. It's a real kind of simple proposition. Does that reporter go back to speak to his in-laws and say, you know, I did today. I went off and I saw this guy saying, and I said, unless you cough up, it's going to be the worst for you. And they all said, oh, that was a good job. Yeah, that's a nice job. Fantastic job you've got, and so on. And by and large, I think that kind of test stands. So the question is how you try and get, you get rather more towards it. Bear in mind also that you might be somebody in a different... Let's say that you're another 7/7 survivor who has started up a charity for 7/7 people, but actually you do have a criminal record, that the information that the reporter thought he had was actually correct. Would that same reporter have been justified in taking the same approach if he had felt that that person was in that situation, and would you have supported it? You probably would. So you can already see that we have some kind of difficulty there. So I would say that the tests are that you have to have some reasonable belief that there is something going on, and it has to be clearly what I would call the public interest. Clearly in the public interest is a real kind of journalistic is a real kind of journalistic thing. So it comes back to this question of reputational, the first question about reputational damage and so on. And here I'm not quite sure I'd completely agree with Paul. I think for the moment there is such significant reputational damage as a result of all this that there will be a very hard line taken in newsrooms. Nobody will want for the next 2, 3, 4 years to be associated with one of these. But here's a problem for Martin, and he may kind of take it on. In the course of this discussion, The Guardian effectively and others came up with the Gordon Brown tale about the hospital visit. Now, the problem with this is, because the hospital records weren't in fact hacked into and so on, as was kind of suggested, but not sort of, you know, there was a kind of problem with that. The other element of the story was based on the Sunday Times gaining access to records using personation. Now, Martin, you know what the problem this is. You know what the problem is, that you do it. you also do it. But you made it seem illegitimate in the course of the article in The Guardian. Now, there is a real problem with this, because we've got to decide whether or not we think this kind of thing goes or not. We've got to decide, for instance, whether or not somebody stealing public secrets, i.e. secrets that belong in a funny kind of way to the public, but also secrets from the public, and selling them for a lot of money, is a legitimate way of behaving. Because if it wasn't, then the whole MP's Cash for MPs scandal wouldn't have happened in the way it did. It would have happened in a completely different way, and in a much more slow burn way that MPs conceivably would have handled, and something simply wouldn't have come out. These are some of the difficulties which I think we have.
Just on the public interest question, there are many of these debates around at the moment. I think it was 2 weeks ago. It seems longer, but that there was a debate at the LSE, about privacy. And at that point, I think the sort of the public mood was very different. And the public mood was that yes, there were question marks around some of the stuff around. But basically, privacy injunctions weren't a very good thing, and then actually they should not be around. And Hugh Tomlinson was on the panel, Hugh Tomlinson, the QC, who is a barrister who represents quite a number of the hacking victims, and he said that what we seem to be going through here is a sort of a really quite painful period of adjustment as a society, where we are trying to find some sort of consensus about what we think the boundaries around our private life should be. And it's particularly painful because the problem is all the practical constraints around reporting on and recording and publishing aspects of our private life have pretty much disappeared. And therefore, all you're left with are cultural and legal constraints. And clearly, in the case of many newspapers, there were no cultural constraints. And so you were left with legal constraints, which was privacy injunctions, which was the sort of the final line. Now, the legal injunction, I mean, they're a very blunt tool, and I don't think they're a very good tool, but they were, I think, the only tool. But what I hope is we're going to do is we're going to have through this difficult, painful process of, I hope, a year or two, is that we will reach more of a societal consensus on the fact that people should have some aspects of their private life, and there should be some boundaries around that, and how we protect those boundaries, I think, is for us as a society to work out. And I hope that they're not just legal boundaries. I hope they are also cultural boundaries.
There's a model in that which should be true and which you just kind of feel isn't. The model in that is that what we'll do is we'll sit down and have a reasonable discussion about what people increasingly believe is private and what isn't. I just don't think that's the way societies evolve. I think it's subject to such enormous social change and social pressure that you can't have a discussion about it. What you end up doing actually is noting where it is and trying, in a sense, to adapt to what it is that you think is seeing around you. I think, firstly, we're going to have to agree what we think it is.
Or where it starts. I mean, the discussions about privacy and when you become a public figure. I mean, those are things that don't get answered. There are lots of people in this room who are not public figures, but who might one day, or maybe next year or in 5 years' time, through hard work, become a public figure. And does that mean that does it mean that something that happened to you yesterday, a row that you had with your husband, boyfriend, mate, some kind of secret that you told somebody, some kind of bad behaviour, now that you're not famous, does it mean that when you become famous, which is apparently dead easy in this kind of society, that suddenly is everybody's property and you can be, blackmailed over it? So when does it even start? Take somebody like Paul, and it's nice to see you, but you became well known, and that wasn't because you went out and said, right, I'm going to be a public figure, this is what I'm going to do. You were thrust into it through no fault of your own. It was part, that's why you became somebody who people had heard of. So there are lots of different parts of this debate, and to focus on what should be private and what shouldn't be private and so on, it's just not broad enough. We have to look at where, who is public property, when does it start, what are the limitations. It's just It's just not wide enough.
So it seems to me that after Diana, we had all this soul searching because she was effectively, you know, her death was, careful here, caused in some, to some extent perhaps by the paparazzi chasing after them. I remember there was a lot of solemn soul searching with media people and national discussion about it, and all the editors said they weren't going to do paparazzi shots anymore, and they weren't going to drive people, hound people, and it was, and that lasted how long? And now I look at the papers now, and they're full of paparazzi shots. And if you're someone like Lindsay Lohan, you know, who's a good-looking girl with a racy lifestyle, she is followed around all the time by the paparazzi, who I think possibly, you know, I'm not saying they buy her a drink, but perhaps drive her to do crazy things. So I'm not convinced that things will change. I also think a factor in the News of the World closing were the advertisers saying, we're not going to put up with this, and the customers saying, the customer pressure on the advertisers, that perhaps it was a commercial decision as much as a penance by Murdoch.
Can I just say about Graham's question? Graham, is what you meant good old, a sort of good old-fashioned journalism? So when you, when the BBC, for instance, or independent production companies want to get some funding so they can investigate something, that there isn't sort of a, if there's more money available, then there won't be a shortcut route where you have to chase somebody or hack a phone. Is that what you mean?
If a free press is worth it, we should do something to keep it.
Yes, I agree with that sentiment. Perhaps as things clean up, that's the way it will go. Let's hope the, you know, traffic is directed in the right direction.
Would taxpayers fund me? I'm a public service, aren't I?
Yeah.
But it might not be just public funding. It might be, you know,
hands up those of you who would like to see 2% added to your income tax.
Oh, well, no one's going
to
put their hand up to that.
Well, there you go.
Well, no one's going to put their hand up to
me.
That's right.
But there are different ways of funding.
I'll take that.
Yeah, well, it's not just for journalism, is it?
No. Also, we're in the last phase of the BBC licence fee.
Hope so.
I mean, it's for fairly obvious reasons, which is that decreasing numbers of people even watch television on the television. And there are all kinds of other kind of functions available. So it's gonna, that's going to alter too. And when it does, the BBC will probably move to some form of subscription basis. I don't know exactly what kind of form of subscription basis it will be. And it will be very interesting to see how it deals with the necessity for the subsidised part of that element, which is less popular but which is regarded as socially important. Because X Factor will make it, The Apprentice will make it.
Yeah. Okay, listen, we really have run out of time. I know it's tragic, but what I want to get from each of the panellists, just to kind of wrap up as neatly as they can, I mean, what we've seen tonight is that this is an extraordinarily complex set of issues, that there's a whole sort of can of the proverbial worms spilling out. But I also wonder whether, you know, in the heat of this moment, you know, have we, what I want to ask these guys, tell me, have we got this completely out of proportion? In 6 months' time, are we actually going to go back to the economy and wars and so on? And if not, what's the one thing that you would kind of like to see emerge out of this festering heap of inquiries and investigations and so on? Martin?
I hope Paul's not right. I hope it's not just a brief interlude. I hope this is a significant change. It certainly feels like it. Certainly feels like it from where we are now. Just one thing that to adds to what David was saying earlier, which is, I hope at this moment that one of the things that the press and journalists will do is start to actually think properly about this whole issue of public interest. And I mean that just because it seems to me we have had endless discussions about privacy injunctions and everything else, and most of the time journalists, particularly in the popular press, won't engage in a discussion about the public interest because they think it's a constraint. They think it's a constraint around what they can do. It seems to me actually, by better defining the public interest and better and more broadly defining the public interest, that actually we can protect good journalism and we can protect, possibly even legally protect, investigative journalism.
Charlotte.
One thing I hope comes out of this, permanently, is that there's a change in the balance of power, and so that newspapers and big media organisations and MPs and the police and the public are on a more even keel, that because this has all been exposed, we've learnt something and we won't be in a position where you can have a newspaper phone up and say, what can you do about this anymore? We're going to publish, and being on the other end of it and feeling totally helpless. I hope this exposure means that everyone is more aware and that the power shifts.
Okay. Paul, what do you hope for apart from more traffic?
I kind of hope that the lobby system will be looked at, because I do think that is problematic, and it's the route by which politicians and the media get into an unhealthy relationship. If you do go down the regulation route, well, I think I will prosper, because the newspapers will continue, in fact accelerate, in their downward spiral.
David.
Of course we've got it out of proportion. It's a media firestorm. All media firestorms are completely out of proportion. If News International executives had simply done a sort of basic job of looking who'd done what some time ago and then fessed up to it, we wouldn't be going through this. Because actually, a lot of these accusations, whilst they're slightly unpleasant, they're not earth-shaking in terms of what it was that we already knew about the media. It's actually been the process by which it's been uncovered as much as anything else, which has given rise to the kind of storm it is, and which actually is creating now what could be the long-term consequence of this, which is the collateral damage in terms of media structures. I do think there will be some positive things come out of it. I do think it constructs a discussion about media ethics. I think that media savviness, as I said right at the beginning, the need for people growing up in society today, surrounded by this cornucopia of information far greater than any time in human history, their capacity to discriminate between good and bad sources, good and bad reporting, good and bad information, etc., is going to be absolutely critical. It's what's going to define possibly the next 50 years, maybe the next 100 years. And if that's part of the process, good. If it just lapses into a kind of hysteria. I'll just say one word about it, giving the idea of this hysteria. I love always is that MPs are described as being brave when they're actually being at their most cowardly, as they are right now. It takes no bravery to be anti-Murdoch in Parliament today. Quite the reverse.
Well, listen, if, as David suggests, that this sort of media literacy and ethics discussion is somewhere we should continue, well, it's definitely where Polis is centred. And regardless of whether this is just a temporary firestorm, we are going to be pursuing this over the next months and, I hope, years. And I hope that you'll stick with us and that you'll feed back onto the blog and we can get these people back, because it's been a really complex, fascinating discussion, and I think to be continued. But thank you very much for you to come in.